You're listening to 10 Points, a podcast with your hosts, Ash and Nicholas, where all the talk is Canadian Highlander, our favorite format from the best trading card game ever, Magic the Gathering.
Hey everyone, it's me, Nicholas.
And me, Ash.
And today we're going to be talking about how to build on a budget.
But before we get into that, we need to talk about our best card from. And today, the set we're looking at is Nemesis. So Nick, you want to talk about the cards you found in this set?
Yeah, I'd say the best card, the one that sees the most play, is probably Daze. It's just a free counter, and free counter spells are just really good. Being able to go shields down without going shields down can be really strong. And Daze sees play in a variety of archetypes, from tempo to control to maybe a little bit of combo. It's just really good.
Yeah, honestly, Daze is probably the one out of these two cards that I've cast more times, but the card that I've selected is Flame Rift. It is one of the most efficient two drops in the burn style decks, the blitz red style decks that are trying to eliminate your life total really fast. It's just a really solid two drop. So we both picked solid two drops out of the set.
Yep, and both of them are pretty decent budget options.
Wow, I didn't even...
Segway.
You mean your budget Force of Will?
Ooh, yes. Okay, it's a new episode now. Put foil into your budget decks. It's just really... I'm kidding, don't do that. Don't play foil.
Start the thing.
Alright, so we're talking about how to build a Canadian Highlander deck on a budget. But that means different things to everyone. To some people, a budget is $5,000. To some people, a budget is $100. So start by determining your budget, figuring out what you can actually afford. And that's going to be a good baseline for what you can decide to do with your deck.
Now, a few ways to kind of help you figure out what that budget is and what that means to you. There are a couple things you want to keep in mind. The first is if your local scene allows proxies. I know that our local meta and our local community has taken the same approach to proxies as the Yellow Jacket store, where if you're listening to this, you probably know what that is. If not, tweet at Nicholas. And
I don't have a Twitter.
That was the joke.
Sure.
That was the joke. Tweet at me.
I ruined it.
It's fine. Listen. The proxy policy we use is you can use up to 10 proxies in your deck. It helps take the edge off of those really crazy expensive cards while still, you know, incorporating respect for the game and, you know, keeping people playing with real physical cards. But that's a discussion for another day. The point is we allow 10 proxies, so if your local community allows that, for example, 10 proxies, then your budget really widens up quite a bit because you get to take the 10 most expensive cards off of your list when you're counting the price. And another important thing to think about is if your local scene allows Gold Border, Collector's Edition, or Magic 30 cards in your community, which most Canadian Highlander groups do. And if that's the case, that's going to help affect your budget as well, because you're going to find that cards aren't as expensive in those forms.
Yeah, and then once you've done all that, you've kind of figured out like what kind of stuff you can delete from the list, then you kind of want to decide what kind of deck you are interested in playing, like what kind of archetype, what like game plan you want. But then once you've done that, you have to determine if that deck can even function on a budget, because unfortunately, while a lot of Canadian Highlander decks work on a budget, maybe not optimally, but they work, there are some decks that simply don't.
Unfortunately, so, this is true even if you're playing with proxies.
Yeah. Like a good example would be like Storm or Eggs. Those are both kind of decks that really don't work on a budget. Maybe Eggs, if you are allowing proxies, works a little bit better because you can proxy the Lotus and the duels. But even then, you're still not going to be... It's not going to be a couple $100 deck.
Yeah. An example of some decks that are really easy to build on a budget, especially if you have an existing collection, which we'll get to in a minute, are most mid-range decks you can build very functional versions of on a pretty modest budget. Even more so for most aggro decks, because aggro decks tend to be fewer colors, and the cards tend to be a little less ubiquitous in other formats. So you get to play a lot more quartered cards. A lot of control decks, while I think they tend to push up a little bit more on price than their mid-range counterparts, can be built on a budget without too much of a headache.
Yeah, and it is worth saying, pick a deck that can be updated as your budget increases. So, like, a really good example of a budget deck that a lot of people will bring up is, oh, if you're looking for a budget deck, build Red Deck Wins, or, like, Goblins or something.
I feel like Goblins keeps creeping up in price.
It does. Red Deck Wins is definitely, like, the golden child of budget decks.
Yeah, but the problem with that is... All you have to do is play Ragavan.
Well, okay, I suppose you have to make a couple sacrifices.
Yeah. You kind of miss out on Eidolon of the Great Revel and Ragavan.
Eidolon's expensive?
Alright, you keep talking, I'll figure it out.
I don't really play Red Deck Wins. But the problem with the deck is it can't really be upgraded past a certain point. So, like, once you kind of built it, that's what you get. So you can be easy to get bored of it and not really have anything to work towards. As to where, like, let's say you build a mid-range deck, like Green-Black Rock, you can build a pretty decent budget version, but then you can just, like, slowly over time pick up one card, and then another card, and then another card, and slowly get that list to the point that you want it. It kind of gives you something to work towards.
Eidolon is not that expensive. I swear it used to be. It's not that expensive. It's like $7. But to piggyback off of what you were just saying, one thing that I've seen many people do is they start off in a mid-range or control deck with their, you know, blue-black control or green-black rock or like a blue-red kind of control-y, slightly burning kind of deck. And then as they've played more and been able to invest a little more into their deck, they've increase into a third color and opened up their strategy that way.
Yeah. And there's even, like, you can add, like, in mid-range decks or something, you can add, like, packages, you can add, like, a lands package, or you could add, like, a combo package. Like, there's a lot of different routes that you can take if you pick kind of an open-ended deck.
Yeah, see episode 22 of the podcast if you're interested in learning about packages.
Good plug.
I try.
Yeah. The next thing you kind of want to do, look at what you already have access to. Most Magic players are not coming into Canadian Highlander without having played any other formats before. So chances are you've got like a Commander deck or a Modern deck or Standard. Like, you've got some cards that you might be able to, pull some cards and be like, okay, I have kind of like some cards that would fit into Blue Moon strategy, so I'm going to try to build that, or something like that. So yeah, see what you've got.
Yeah, I think that a good example, like a good way to explain this, is just give you my story, what I built when I first started playing Highlander. I was coming from Modern, where I had played Esper, kind of Esper control, kind of Esper mid range, depending on how you define it. In my opinion, looking back, it was more mid-rangey than I claimed that it was. I claimed it was very much control, and it was very much mid-range.
You were playing, three Geist of Saint Drafts or something.
No. I think I was on one Geist, but I was on, like, three Lingering Souls.
Sure, I remember that.
And, like, Thought Seizes and Inquisitions. It's not important. And Tassigar. It was not a control deck, is what I'm trying to say. But that's really not the point. The point is, I already had the land base and a couple staple cards for an Esper. Granted, I called it control, but it was moderately control-ish once I transitioned it to Highlander, because I pretty much just added control cards, but I had a few mid-range cards left over. But because I already had the fetches and the shocks and Glacial Fortress and Drowned Catacombs, it wasn't that hard to invest into just singles that I needed for, you know, actual spells, and then just a couple lands, and then that set me up to be able to put together a pretty functioning deck for really, I think I spent like $50, and that was just coming out of my modern deck plus $50 on top of it, and it was not hard to assemble that. So that's where I started out.
Yeah, I started, I mean, mine was also from my existing collection. Mine was much worse. when I very first started playing Magic, I really liked green. I don't know why I liked green so much, but I really liked green.
You don't like green nearly as much as you used to.
No, I don't. But I was like, I was green all the way. And I found, I found like an eBay listing or something for like, it was one of those like bulk, like you get like 3,200 cards, like 200 rares or something like that, but they were all green, and I was like, this is great, this is perfect.
Why waste my time with all these colors that aren't green?
I just had a whole heck of a lot of like green stuff, so I built like a mono green like ramp deck, playing like a bunch of mana dorks and ramp spells and big dumb green creatures. And, I mean, the deck, like, did things sometimes. It was very inconsistent, but I think that was maybe more me being bad at deck building, more than not having access to the right cards.
Yeah. How about you talk about your next deck that you actually built and iterated on?
Yeah, then I went into Grixis Control, which was way, way better. I'd played Commander a decent bit, so I had, like, several Commander decks that were playing, like, a lot of the kind of, like, more expensive Grixis spells. So really all I had to do was go pick up, like, a Lightning Bolt and a Fatal Push, and, like, I was able to build a very reasonable Grixis Control deck that actually did things.
I think we've told this story before, but back in the day when, you know, Nicholas and I both had much smaller collections, we were jamming the same matchup a lot, which included my Esper deck versus his Grixis deck, and which I recall being quite enjoyable.
It was.
But I just like to remind people that several times I have watched Nicholas target my Torrential Gearhulk with a Lightning Bolt. And then target my Torrential Gearhulk with 3 damage from an Abrade to finish it off. Forgetting that Torrential Gearhulk is an artifact and Abrade can just destroy it by itself. And I refuse
like
to let him live.
5 plus years ago.
There's no way it was that long.
I don't have any idea how long ago it was, but you're still bringing it up.
It's probably like 3... You know, honestly, maybe it was. Not the point. I mean, again, not important. Yeah. But, you know... You can build a pretty functioning mid-ranger control deck with effects that are slightly less efficient, but, you know, 15 times cheaper.
For example, Torrential Gearhulk is a really good budget option for control lists. As, wow. Like...
I'm not... That's just playing Pioneer now. I don't know if that one's cheap anymore. It's probably pretty cheap.
Maybe not, I don't know.
No, it's cheap. It's $2.
See, there you go. Torrential Gearhulk, good control finisher if you are building on a budget.
Yeah, and, you know, you don't see a braid that often in mid-range decks as much as you would see it in, like, RDW, for example. But if you are building, you know, like a Jund mid-range deck, and you can't quite afford the Assassin's Trophy, you could slot it in a braid, and that takes care of a lot of the same things that the Assassin's Trophy was meant to remove. So sometimes just playing slightly less efficient effects, or you know, ones that the colors are a little harder, they can really go a long way in making your deck more affordable.
Yeah, good segue. Speaking of colors being a little bit harder,
I try.
You should probably try to limit your colors. I know me and Ash both just talked about my first deck was mono green, but I very quickly transitioned into Grixis. So I know we both just talked about our first decks being 3 colors, but I would recommend sticking with 2 colors You can go into three if you already have, like, some sort of mana base. So if you've got, like, the fetches and the shocks and you can pick up, like, some of the pain lands and the check lands, some of the cheaper duels, then three colors is fine. But if you're, like, really trying to build on a budget, really just trying to, like, fill out the format and get a deck, I'd stick with two colors and just have the possibility of adding a third later on.
Yeah. One example of why we were able to play Grixis and Esper on lower budgets, even with an okay mana base, my Esper deck didn't have the best mana base. I think one reason that I was able to work so well is because if you're playing a slower blue deck, you can manage to play a lot of cantrips, which can really even out your draws and help you with your mana. So you can get away with a suboptimal mana base. Another thing that can help with that is if you play, like, you make decisions on the spells you're going to include in your deck to respect the fact that your mana base is suboptimal. So that example of playing a Braid over Assassin's Trophy, not only is it much cheaper of a card, it also saves you a lot on your needing specific colors of mana. You only need one red instead of a green and a black.
Yeah. It's also worth noting, which this could be, like, relevant for you too, depending on your situation. When me and Ash got into Canadian Highlander, there was no one in our community that played it. So we, like, we built decks and we jammed against each other, and then we slowly kind of started getting people into it. So everyone was kind of on the same playing field as far as, like, not having optimal mana bases, not having enough experience to, like, build an optimized list. So we kind of, like, were able to grow into the format as a community because we kind of just grew a community. So if you're, like, going into an already established competitive community, it's probably more important than when it was for us to be in, like, two colors, because you're not going to have to deal with that mana screw or getting, like, just getting, like, shafted by your mana base.
Yeah. And I will say, I think, myself included, a lot of people sometimes overvalue playing additional colors. Like, I think a lot of people don't think that, you know, X given two-color combination, like, why would I play this when I can splash this and have all these cards? When, if you look at it, you know, green-black, while it's not quite as efficient at dealing with everything that Jund or Abzan or Sultai might be, green-black does have the tools to deal with most situations. If you are willing to, you know, you kind of take the hit on a few percentage points, but the benefit you get is you can increase the consistency of your mana base and B, reduce the price of it. So, you know, all that to say, playing two colors isn't that bad.
Yeah, I think it's easy to fall. Like, once you have, like, the ability to build any mana base, it's easy to fall into the trap of, oh, like, I can just play a third color and it doesn't hurt me. But it's not necessary.
Yeah. This isn't a point on our list, but it is a thing I just thought of, which is, while we're on the topic of mana, something you can do, and I've seen a lot of people do, and this is kind of common knowledge, but if you take your weakness of playing, you know, a less diverse mana base, a lot of basic lands, and take that and use it as an advantage by incorporating Blood Moon or Back to Basics or Magus of the Moon or Hall of Gemstone in your deck, or Price of Progress, that can be an effective way to, you know, kind of break the, restore balance to your situation.
Yeah, I do think Back to Basics and Blood Moon are kind of expensive, but
maybe not. Blood Moon's down. Back to Basics might be a little bit, but Blood Moon, I sold one the other day for, like, less than $10.
Oh, Back to Basics isn't that bad either. So yeah, I mean, I mentioned Blue Moon earlier. That could actually be a pretty reasonable option to build on a budget.
I would have to agree. Some of the more expensive cards that you miss out on when you're not playing on a budget is your untapped duels. You only have access to one untapped fetchable dual land, which is Steam Vents, unless you have access to proxies where you can play Volcanic Island. You do have many options for fetchable tapped duels now that are very affordable with the Snow duels and the Dominaria United duels. So you have a lot of fetchable options, which is good. But it doesn't really matter because you only need like two or three and then you're fetching basics anyways. But yeah. I think the expensive cards in this deck you're going to miss out on are like Jace the Mind Sculptor, your big pointed forces. Cards. Yeah, Forces, your big pointed cards if you wanted to play Recall. You're probably going to miss out on that. Probably Mana Drain as well.
Yeah, I think like you can build like a pretty decent, like if you go like Treasure Cruise, Dig Through Time, True Name Nemesis, maybe a Soul Ring.
Mystical Tutor might be down low enough to utilize it.
Yeah, and that goes back to a previous point of like determining your budget. Like at Mystical Tutor, it's probably like $10 right now or something. So, like depending on your budget, I mean, $10 isn't a lot, but if every card in your deck is $10, then that adds up pretty quick. So, yeah,
Mystical Tutor is actually a bit less because it's still off that Dominaria remastered reprint. It's pretty low. This is actually another thing we didn't write down, but I think you would probably agree with is. You can dedicate more of your budget to key cards than just, like, role players. Like, yeah. As good as Force of Will is, like, it's a great card, and I would love to have it in basically every deck I play. That doesn't mean that I want to, you know, I don't want to spend more money on that than the Thassa's Oracle if I'm building a Thassa's Oracle deck. And I have to pick one, you know? I would rather play one of the better tutors or like the second piece that combos with Thassa's Oracle than spend too much on Force of Will so I can't play the key parts of the deck. So it's okay to budget a bit more to the cards that are more important to the deck or cards that you're going to be tutoring for or, you know, really helping your gameplay out. I think that Blue Moon is the kind of deck where it kind of part of its charm is that it can switch its game plan kind of on a dime. So being able to be in a controlling situation and then just you want to Mystical Tutor for Bonfire of the Damned and dome them for 7, if that's what you want to be able to do, then Mystical Tutor might be worth devoting some extra dollars to.
Yeah, and that's like kind of to expand off of that point. When you're building a budget deck and you're like looking at lists online and stuff, look at the cards and then find out which cards don't have a replacement. Because like a lot of cards, like especially like threats and counters, there's usually like a cheaper option that will still like function in that slot. But there's some cards like usually like tutors or fast mana that like your options get real bad real quick. So if you're deciding where to allocate your budget, maybe put it more towards that fast mana or those tutors rather than like the specific threats or counters, as you can kind of afford to pick some more budget-friendly options.
Yeah, and this kind of circling back to a point we didn't quite finish. If you're looking at a list, you know, an example list of the style deck you want to play, and you're seeing that there's a lot of cards that don't have replacements and you kind of need them all for the deck to work, this is probably not the deck you're going to be able to start with.
Yeah.
Which, you know, we kind of talked about Storm as an example. You're looking at Storm and you say, okay, I need an Underworld Breach and I need a Lion's Eye Diamond and I need a Brain Freeze. Those are all important. I'm going to need this Demonic Tutor because I'm not doing the Lotus build. I'm going to need, you know, this squander resources because we need all these extra mana options. And wow, Lotus Petals $25. You know, you start to realize that not all these very important cards to the deck and they don't have replacements, that's not going to be an option as a budget deck. With the exception of a proxy policy that makes it work for you.
Yeah. And this is maybe getting into a little more complex territory than we really need to, but if you do like find a deck like Storm that you are like, man, I really want to build like Storm, but I can't, like it doesn't fit in the budget right now, you could potentially like build a deck that is somewhat Storm adjacent, so that you are kind of like already picking up the cards for Storm, and then further down the line you get like the rest of the pieces you need. Now, I guess I don't really know what decks fit into the Storm adjacent category that aren't also expensive. Like maybe Slushy kind of fills the...
Well, I mean, you're just buying Alliance and Diamond for that.
Yeah,
assuming maybe. I got my timeline right, if you don't know what Slushy is, it's a blue-white control deck or a Jeskai control deck. It's either Jeskai or blue-white splashing red for Brain Freeze Underworld Breach combo. And depending on if I have my timeline right, this episode should be releasing 2 weeks before Paperlander, where I play Slushy. So come see how it goes.
Yeah. That's going to be like really embarrassing if the Paperlander. I mean, it shouldn't come out before this, but
if it does, then go back and watch the most previous Paperlander, number 11.
Yeah. But yeah, let's. You just want to like start talking about a couple of examples of decks that could make good budget options.
Hold on. Let me skim our outline and make sure I didn't miss anything. Oh, one notable thing I did want to say. If you're kind of really set on playing a three-color deck that is not blue, the odds are it is green, unless it's exactly Mardu, in which case, more power to you. But something you can get out of green is you can have access to mana dorks, which can really help your mana. It's because we now have access to a decent number of mana dorks that aren't too expensive that can help with your mana depending on the colors you're playing, such as Avacyn's Pilgrim or Sylvan Caryatid and Ignoble Hierarch. I believe Birds of Paradise and Noble Hierarch are still a little more up there, but if you're the kind of deck that is playing mana dorks, better mana dorks might be something worth attributing a bit more of your budget to, because they're going to A, be useful in a lot of archetypes that are similar to what you're trying to play, and B, are going to be very helpful to fleshing out your mana base. Okay, now we can move on to examples.
Alright, Deese. I mean, starting with, we mentioned earlier, probably the best option for budget decks is going to be an aggro deck. So red deck wins, probably the best, but there's like a lot of aggro decks that you can build for pretty cheap. Like Black Mold could be pretty budget. Like we said, Ash said earlier, Goblins is getting a little bit more expensive, but you can still.
I would like to say, I think that the tier version of Goblins is getting more expensive, but a functional version of Goblins is not that bad. Especially like, because the most expensive part for the actual combo is, I think, Goblin Recruiter itself or Kiki Jiki. And those are both less than $10, I believe. And you can just, like, you know, a lot of the more efficient goblins, like, I think most of your money you're spending on at that point is Warren Instigator and Goblin Lackey. But, you know, maybe Rabble Master if that one's randomly expensive.
I don't think so.
Yeah,
like, maybe $2.
Yeah. If you do mono red and you're not doing a mock spread, it's pretty reasonable to do on a more reasonable budget. I can say that because I built it on a reasonable-ish budget. I added a few things over time, but it still does well when you have a good pilot behind it.
So what you're saying is that you built a budget deck, and then over time, as your budget increased, you upgraded the deck slowly.
That would be accurate, yes.
Callback.
We did it. Another deck that I've seen, I think two people play, specifically one player in particular, is a red-black aggro. This isn't like what you saw in Paperlander, where it was red-black sacrifice or anything like that. It wasn't a synergistic deck. It was just a straightforward, I'm going to kill you with these red and black creatures. And it was very good. It played a good amount of burn. It played a lot of one mana 2Xs. A couple that reanimated themselves, and it was just a really efficient aggro deck. And I must say that deck plays a lot of draft chaff, and it still kills people. I don't see that player come around all that often, but when I do, I often see him at table one or two.
Yep, if you want to learn how to build a Rakdos aggro deck, you can go watch episode 7, where we...
Oh yeah, we did do that.
We did a live brew.
I'm not convinced that list is completely perfect, but I think that list is probably a good jumping off point.
It's pretty budget as well. It's only $21,000.
There are moxes in that
list. Yeah, there's moxes and duels.
Yeah, which you don't need.
No.
One other aggro deck is Mono Green Stompy. There are a few key pieces that take Mono Green Stompy from probably tier 2.5 to tier 1.5.
Such as Mox Emerald.
Mox Emerald, Gaia's Cradle, Raphelos. I feel like there's another one. Sylvan Library is really good in that deck. That card, I think, is like $25 or something like that. But, you know,
I think it's
if you already have that. Yeah, it might be more. But Mono Green Stompy, most of the actual creatures that are filling out your curve aren't that expensive. And that is a really affordable deck that I would suggest if you're looking to play aggro but not red. I've seen that deck do some really fun things.
Yeah. If you're looking for another good budget option, a really good choice is Reanimator. You can build... Reanimator is a really good example of a deck that can be upgraded over time, but B, like, there's just so many big dumb creatures that you can use as reanimation targets. Sure, you're probably not going to get like the best ones, like you're not getting like an Elish Norn or Grizzle like an Brand. Archon of Cruelty or a Grizzlebrand, but
you're getting Inkwell Leviathan.
Yeah, reanimating an Inkwell Leviathan is usually just like good enough, or like a Runescar Demon or something
The one that people are playing in Modern from Modern Horizons 2, Sarah's Emissary.
I have no clue.
Give like your board like pro creatures or pro instants. It's good. Now that is with that deck, there are a couple things I want to comment on. One, because if you're playing a higher than average amount of card draw, specifically cantrips and looting effects, you can actually get away with a 3-color mana base that has less than your perfect number of good lands, because you get to play so many looting effects and cantrips, you're going to be able to find them and get your mana set up a little better. Now, that's not to say your lands will never come back and bite you if they're not great, but you can get away with it more than you could in a deck that's not drawing cards. That's one note. Did you want to comment on that?
I was just going to say, that being said, I don't know if it's absolutely necessary. Like, you're probably in, like, Dimir, and then if you want to add a third color, you're adding red.
I would say you probably want to be going into red, because you need...
Yeah, I guess you get a lot of the good looting effects in red.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think you kind of need to be in Grixis, maybe into a fourth color, if you want to splash white. Not as budget, just in general. Oh, yeah. You have to be in Grixis, and you might splash white for flashing back on burial rites, but that's like it. But the other thing I wanted to say, again, that's not for a budget build. Yes. The other thing I wanted to say about Reanimator is we were talking earlier about deciding what cards are actually worth spending more of your budget on, and for Reanimator, it is unfortunately going to be the reanimation spells themselves. Most of the good reanimation spells are not particularly cheap. A couple of them are, but most of them are not. I don't think any of them are like insanely expensive, but they, you know, because you need a certain number of them, that kind of adds up. But on the flip side of that coin, you can get away with playing a little fewer than you maybe should if you put in more looting and card draw in place of him to help you find the ones you do have.
And it's also worth noting, while yes, the reanimation spells can be fairly expensive, this is kind of what we were talking about earlier with like allocating our budget, you can kind of splurge a little bit more on those expensive reanimation spells, because a lot of the looting effects and the reanimation targets have really, really good budget options.
Yeah, very, very low price points.
like the only really expensive thing in the deck that you have to spend money on is the reanimation spells, and then everything else can be
like you're if you really want to play some really good key control cards, then those can be a little pricey. But besides that, I will say this is one negative to playing Reanimator is if you're not really confident that you really like it and you are going to want to keep it around, the actual reanimation spells being the things you spend money on can kind of, you know, can be a rose with a thorn. If you don't want to keep playing Reanimator, you don't have anything else to build with those reanimation spells aside from like Tin Fins combo or a weird mid-range deck. You know, a lot of the reanimation spells don't have that many other homes. So that is, you know, make sure that you're not putting too many eggs in one basket if that basket is fragile. I feel like I talk in way too many metaphors and analogies.
Yeah, that metaphor was like, it took me a second to like get to the end of it, but you know, I mean, I'm here for it.
Let me know in the comments if I'm speaking in too many metaphors, analogies, and what's the third one? Anyways, right, you want to talk about Ash's death and taxes?
Thinking, I was about to say, well, Ash is thinking about the third one. I'm going to talk about death and taxes. Out of everything on our list, this is probably the one that has the most... Like, once you get to the point that you've upgraded it to its max potential, it has the most competitive, like, final form, if you will.
Dude, this deck is so good.
But you can build pretty reasonable versions of it that are not necessarily top tier, but are fairly budget. And a lot of that comes from, A, the fact that you can build mono-white D&T, and that's just, like, really good.
Most versions are approximately mono-white.
Yeah, if you're doing anything else, you're adding, like, a little bit of black, but that's just a splash anyway. But
well, some do a little bit of colorless.
Well, I mean... Sure.
Is effectively another color.
Yeah. But you don't have to buy, like, original duels for...
I mean, you kind of got to buy, like, Ancient Tomb.
Well, Ancient Tomb is much less than, Scrubland. Alright,
You know what? Yeah, you're... Okay, whatever.
But Death and Taxes, there's a lot, like... There's so many cards that could potentially go in D&T that if you just pick a lot of the more budget ones, it can still be like a really good Death and Taxes list. And then over time you can start picking up the like more expensive pieces. The big things in this deck that you're going to miss out on the budget version are probably like either like Mana Crypt or... Mox Pearl. But, I mean, you
Ancient
can...
Ancient Tomb, Wasteland.
Ancient Tomb, Wasteland. But those are, like, much on the cheaper end. Still not super cheap, like, probably 30, 40 bucks each.
Yeah, a couple of the... Ancient Tomb, we just checked the other day. It's, like, $70 for no reason.
Dang, really?
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
Crazy. I don't know
Ancient
if
Ancient Tomb was, like, 30 bucks when I bought it, so...
A couple other of the more expensive cards that you'll probably miss out on if you're going for a more budget build of Death and Taxes is the new Adeline is like kind of expensive because of Pioneer. The Stoneforge Mystic and the equipment package. You probably still want to be playing some of them even if you're not playing Stoneforge, but those can kind of add up in price, so you might see dropping off a couple of those.
Is Jutae still expensive?
I don't think it's that bad, and that's actually, I was about to say, I think Jutae is probably worth your, it's not bad. It's like less than 15 depending on the printing, almost like $6 for the list printing on TCG Player. So even if it were more expensive, I think that that's probably worth spending a bit more of your money on.
For sure. I mean, yeah, $6, like, that's fairly cheap for... A card as powerful as Umezawa's Jutae, especially in Death and Taxes. That is a deck that really, really likes to have it. Kind of moving on to like another good. We talked about it a little bit earlier, but control and mid-range lends itself to more so mid-range than control. I guess we'll do these one at a time. Mid-range really lends itself to being built on a budget pretty well, specifically just because mid-range is such kind of like a wide archetype that you can build pretty much any like version on a budget. So like Jund mid-range, there's so many good threats in Jund and like so many fairly decent ways to build it that you don't really have to buy like the Minsk and Boo and the Ren and Six and the
well, Minsk and Boo is like $10, so
it's like 20.
I don't think so. I think you're looking at the foil.
No. Oh. Well, I mean, I guess like Ren and Six and Ragavan, like you don't have to play those.
Sorry. Hmm? While I've already interrupted, I just want to say, I was just checking with our local, a community member in the 10 Points Discord channel, known for Death and Taxes. I just checked and we're getting a budgety D&T list. So we'll have it linked for you. This one's like probably on the higher end of what you would consider budgeted. Well, maybe medium. It's going to be about 250 with no proxies. That is the order I put in. So we'll see.
I'd say like that's like if you're, I guess we didn't really talk about this much earlier. If you're planning on getting into Canlander, like even a budget list, I mean, 250 is probably about where you're going to be. And
that's probably the whole thing though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if you already have your Jitte and Stoneforge from that one commander deck you like, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I guess it is worth noting like you can't really build like a $50 budget Canlander deck. You're more going to be aiming for kind of 200-ish.
Yeah.
But like I said, most people already have some of the pieces, so you can maybe get away with only spending $50.
All right. Yeti does not know that I'm currently recording as I message him on Discord.
Yeah, I keep watching these chats pop up, and it's really amusing. He just asked if the player has a mana crypt. I'm responding. Leave in the comments if you own a mana. I'm kidding. No, don't do that.
Okay, now please continue. You were talking about mid-range.
Yeah, mid-range. There's almost, like we were talking about earlier, where like a lot of decks, kind of the key cards have like a budget option. Mid-range, pretty much every single card in the entire list is going to have a budget option. Like, even going so far down the chain as Lightning Bolt, like, if for some reason you can't spend $3 on Lightning Bolt, you can buy Chain Lightning. That's, I guess, a bad example, because if you can't spend $3 on Lightning Bolt, you probably shouldn't be building mid-Canlander or Jund.
Nicholas, I can tell that it's been a while since you've purchased a Lightning Bolt, because they are playable in $30 Vintage. They are a quarter now.
Are they really?
Well, the cheapest printing is, but they're like a dollar.
Dang. Okay, well, I guess buy your Lightning Bolts now or something.
You should go back to a different example. Like, use Terminate instead of Dreadbore.
Dreadbore is like super cheap too. But
this whole episode is gonna be plagued by us getting numbers wrong.
Yeah. So like the most expensive card in your deck is like Glorybringer, which is of course very expensive. No, I'm kidding. That's a good option. Fury is like 30, 40 bucks or something like that, maybe. Glorybringer kind of is a good role player that is like super cheap and still is really good in your Jund midrange list. So you can like swap your Furies out for Glorybringers and your Thoughtseize out for Duress. You don't have to be on all of these really expensive cards. You can just play the slightly more budget versions of each of them and then upgrade it over time.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people that have started off in the format, you know, just their option for just trying it out was just, aside from people who just kind of converted a commander deck, they just take like a pile of cards they like that are happen to be in these three colors and say, here's some removal, here's some creatures, here's a few planeswalkers, let's jam. And that's just kind of gonna end up being a mid-range deck a lot of the time. And, you know, if you happen to already have that Fury, great. But if you don't, as Nicholas said, there are a lot of other really cheap options that do a pretty good job filling that spot. Even if it's not the efficient removal that Fury is, Glorybringer kills something.
Yeah.
And leaves behind a body.
And that's another reason that mid-range is such a good option, is that most people already have pieces that would fit into a mid-range deck because it's so, like, broad. Like, for combo decks, a lot of people don't have specific combo pieces or something, but
no
like,
one just a has a people, random squandered resources.
Yeah, but a lot of people have various efficient creatures in, like, Abzan colors. And so you just put those into your Abzan deck, throw Swords to Plowshares and a Path to Exile on top of it, and like you're doing well.
Yeah, I think another reason that mid-range decks can work so well in the, especially in the budget space, is if you happen to have a couple more efficient, like more expensive, efficient removal spells because you already had them, you can add in a few more of the, or budget a little more for things that make yourself a little more of a controlling mid-range deck and lean into that side of your game plan. But if the more pricey cards you already had were, like, you randomly had a, we'll say you opened a Minskaboo with the pre-release and you have a Kalitas Trader of Get, you can kind of lean into your more, like, aggressive, powerful threes and fours kind of mid-range deck and play a little less removal and just kill them.
Yeah, so, kind of go for the, like, mana dork on one,
yeah,
kind of three drop on two sort of mid-range deck.
So mid-range lets you kind of lean into your strengths, like, your from a budget perspective, lean into the strengths that you have or already own, so you don't have to spend as much. You just might have to lean into a certain style of mid-range. And honestly, I think control is a little similar to that, where you can go for the long control game if that's the stuff you're like. If you have a Teferi, Hero of Dominaria, for whatever reason, from that commander deck, that one, what's the one commander deck? It doesn't matter.
A Shorakai commander deck. I don't know.
Yeah, sure. You have a Shorakai commander deck. So you have a Shorakai and you have a Teferi. You have a Teferi Time Raveler and a Teferi Hero of Dominaria. Well, you know, you're set up to be able to play the kind of game where you know, lock up the game and then win later. But if you have a Chandra Torch of Defiance from something, and you have a Torrential Geralt from something else, you can maybe lean into that Blue Moon strategy of control where you're controlling the game long enough to start killing them really fast. And you're not looking to play quite as many turns as Blue-White control is. But I don't think that's quite as flexible as the mid-range thing is, but I think that it is, still to an extent.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about a couple of, or are you open to me talking about a couple specifics in the budget options for control?
Sure.
One thing for control that is great is control, I think, more than most, like more than mid-range, you can do a lot with two-color pairings, which you can't really do with mid-range as well, in my opinion. Your lands are usually better because you don't mind the type of lands that can come in untapped, but sometimes are tapped, because you're usually a little more flexible with your land playing, so you don't have to freak out as much about playing Port Town or Prairie Stream that may or may not come in untapped. So that's one reason I think playing control is good, and those lands can be pretty cheap. But another thing is, a lot of your interaction options are more flexible than, your best options in mid-range decks. So, like, your efficient counter spells, you know, you would like to be playing Mana Drain and Force of Will and Archmage's Charm. but those can get a bit pricey. So if you can't manage all those, you can still get away with playing Disallow and Mana Leak instead of Mana Drain. It's not as good, but it's still efficient and often does the job. And then you could be looking to play a, you know, if you're looking to play Force of Will for those early turns, you could be replacing it with a Spell Snare or even a Force Spike. I've seen people play Force Spike in control and it worked very well. So you have a lot of options that can do an okay job. You also in control can play a lot of basics in a two color deck, so you don't need to worry as much about playing high numbers of non-basic lands. You play most of the ones that you can that are good, but you don't have to worry about it as much as you would in a three color deck. And then, oh, and most of the cantrips, which are going to fill out a lot of your lower end of the curve, like your Ponder, your Preordain, your Brainstorm, and others like Opt and Consider, they aren't really that expensive. So they help you fill out those kind of staple cards without breaking the bank too fast.
Yeah.
You have any specifics on control?
I don't think so.
Oh. Jace Architect of Thought is not as good as Jace the Mind Sculptor, not even close, but it's still fun.
It's like Baby Factor Fiction and does other things as well.
Yeah, that. Especially in blue-white control, you do have a lot of really efficient spot removal, probably more than blue-black, I think, as far as one mana options. Probably better than blue-red as well for one mana options, but the blue-red ones, of course, can go face if you choose to do so. So
yeah, that's... and blue-black and blue-red, it is worth noting that the removal spells are probably a little more budget-friendly. Not that the white ones are terribly expensive, but like Path is more than Go for the Throat.
Yeah, I will say blue-white or blue-black is a little awkward that one of your best spot removal spells in Fatal Push is much harder, or it's less good when you're playing fewer fetches in your deck.
Yeah.
So that's something to take note of, I suppose.
Yes, that is relevant.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. Do you have any other comments on any of our specific examples here?
I don't think so. I think we're good to go into our closing segment.
All right. Well, do you want to talk about what you played most recently? I know you've been real busy recently, but you played last week, I think.
I think it was
the previous week.
The previous week, but yeah, I played blue green extra turns. It's a deck that isn't particularly known for how great it is, but it can put up results, and it's so much fun to play.
One of those statements is true.
I don't know which statement he is referring to, but I'm going to talk about how I did. I went 2-1, which is pretty decent. My first match, I was against blue-white control. Caroline was playing it. Game one, I got just, like, destroyed. I was doing great. I was way ahead. Well, like, somewhat ahead. I had an Ancestral Visions coming off of Suspend on my next turn, and I had a Dictative Crucifix in my hand that I was planning on casting on her instep. So, like, I was about to start really getting the value engine going the next turn, and then I was gonna I was probably going off either the next turn or, like, the turn after. And then she played a Teferi Time Raveler, which just, if anyone doesn't know, A, it basically says Ancestral Visions cannot no longer be cast. And it also puts me in an awkward position where if I cast my Dictative Crucifix, she can just bounce it. And then if I don't, I can't cast it once the Teferi has resolved, because it only allows you to play things at sorcery speed. So I had to just in response cast the Dictate, and then she bounced it back to my hand. Then on my upkeep, my Ancestral Vision was not able to be cast. And then I played the Dictate on my turn. She drew a card off of it and then destroyed it. And I just lost the game from there. Game 2 was similar to Game 1 in the sense that I had a good value engine going, but she did not have a Teferi Time Unraveler, so I was able to go off. And then Game 3, Game 2, I managed to go off and I had the new Teferi, which is really, really good when you have a Howling Mine on the battlefield, because you can basically just for free make a grow creature every turn, and then if you need more cards, you can draw more cards. And then Game 3 was really, really close. We went to turns, and I had exactly lethal because I had a Hall of the Storm Giants and a Time Walk, and so I was able to attack with a Hall of the Storm Giants, cast Time Walk, and attack again for exactly lethal in turns, and yeah, that's how that ended. Match 2, I was against Blue-White Tempo, and I got destroyed. Game 1, I thought, like, I looked at my hand and I was like, I'm never losing this. I had, like, turn 1 land, Chrome Mox into Talisman into Suspend Ancestral Vision, and then he played, like, the creature that names a card and that card's abilities can't be activated, so he, like,
Scheming Fence?
Yeah. That I guess he turned off my one of my mana rocks, and then he like wastelanded one of my lands, and then later he removed another one of my mana rocks. I think he might have actually stole it with something, I don't know for sure, but basically he managed to completely restrict my mana, and all of those things were also speeding up his clock, and then I just died, and then game two was even less close than game one. And then I got the bye round three. So I guess it's not technically a win, but you know, I consider it somewhat of a win.
Okay, well, I don't have quite as many details for my most recent, but I will share a story nonetheless. But I have a little bit of a preamble, which is for the last while I would say I've been going through what I can best describe as a winning at Magic dry spell. Things have not been going great for the last good while. I have just not been winning just anything at all, and it's felt real bad. But this last week, I almost was just going to take a break for a little while, and then I was like, you know what? I got to practice this deck for Paperlander. So I should just go. So I went, and I was playing Slushy. It's blue, white, splashing a little bit of red. And what I did was I went up against... first deck I went up against was five-color initiative. Well, it's five-color good stuff, basically, featuring a lot of initiative cards because those happen to be good stuffs. And Game 1, I think I just kind of died. I don't really remember. Yeah, I was about to die, and then I played a Blood Moon in my blue-white control deck against the five-color deck, and then somehow my mana ended up being worse than his, and he played a double red spell. He played Seasoned Pyromancer, and it was just bad from there, so I ended up dying. But that's the game I lost. Game 2... I don't even remember exactly how we got to this point, but it was just feeling like garbage time. Like, I just couldn't do anything. I was drawing everything a turn too late. My opponent just had it all. But I was like, I might as well keep playing just in case. And then I, at the perfect time, top decked a Gifts Ungiven. Went to my opponent's turn. They had lethal with the initiative, but missed it and went down the wrong side of the initiative because they, I guess, didn't account for lethal. And I was able to Gifts Ungiven for the combo and pull off the combo on my next turn. And then we went to the next game and I just kind of got murdered. But, you know, it felt like a real game, at least that last game. I don't remember the details that much because this is a little while ago, but, you know, it's all worth it because of that whammy of a comeback on game one. And then I proceeded to lose game three as well. So I ended up losing the match, but it was a good game nonetheless. Some good games anyways. Match two, I went up against what? Oh, you know what? I think I actually won game three of that match because my record ended up being XO. Spoilers. So I actually did win that one. I don't remember. I just remember the amazing comeback. That's all I remember. I think I just kind of had the combo in my hand. The next game, I don't really remember. But round two, I went up against a Sultai Thoracle list. And we had basically three really back and forth close games. But what happened is I lost game one, and then I won game two, and then we go to game three, and my opponent just, like, has the combo in their hand, pretty much. But I managed to wasteland. He has a piece and a tutor, so he tutors for the piece. And I'm able to wasteland him off of being able to combo that turn. So what he ends up doing is I end up threatening lethal, I think with a Dream Trawler. And what he does is he activates... I'm sorry, he casts a Demonic Consultation. And he has to go get a Force of Will with it. But he... because it's on his turn, and he forgot, he went and got Force of Negation with it. So he made a misplay, which resulted in me winning the game. By murdering him with my Dream Trawler. But it was a very close match. It ended up being lost on an onboard misplay, so it was close, but... nonetheless, I got there. And then game or match three, I went up against Chad on his red-green deck, and I ended up getting 2-1, and we had a really close match. I believe I lost game one and won game two, and we made it to game three, and I was in control most of game three, and he basically had a really clean series of plays on the last, like, two turns of the game to set him up for exactly lethal. And I don't believe I made any huge misplays. I think I made one small one, but broadly speaking, we both just played really tight Magic, and it was just a really close match. So I ended up losing that, but we had agreed to draw, and we just were splitting and playing. So I still got my store credit. It was a good time.
There you go.
Yeah, so all that to say, I was in a dry spell for quite a while, and then I ended up going 2-0-1 on the score sheet. 2-1 in reality, but 2-0-1 on the score sheet.
Score sheet's all that matters.
It is. It is. So, yeah. Yeah, I think, do you have anything else to say?
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, if you enjoyed or something, you know, leave a like, leave a comment, subscribe. It helps us out. Tell your friends, and have a good day. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the 10 Points Podcast, and don't forget to count your points.